Hi, Ashita.
Hey, Seth.
What are we talking about today?
The Ship It booklet.
What about it?
We're going to be going through it step by step.
Let's talk roofing. Not the roof of your mouth, not peanut butter, but roofing. Those guys who climb on the top of your house with hammers and nails and chunk, 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 put a roof on. About 15 or 20 years ago, they invented the pneumatic nail gun. And the pneumatic nail gun, you may have heard it, goes doop, doop, doop. Totally changes the way you put in a roof. Now there's only two kinds of roofers in the world. Slow, not particularly competent roofers who are standing up there using a hammer and doing real damage to their arms. And people who have figured out that a pneumatic roofing gun makes it go in half the time and does it actually better job. The invention of the roofing gun wasn't enough. What we needed were for people to figure out how to use it. What we needed for it was for it to create an entire new way of approaching the act of putting a roof on a building. Well, this isn't as technical or specific as a pneumatic roofing gun, but I'm here to talk to you today about this pamphlet I've put together called the Ship It Journal. And what I am trying to do is make you uncomfortable at the beginning of a project. What I'm trying to do is encourage you to add rigor to a project, anything that's worth working on, anything that's worth shipping out the door, whether it's a term paper or a career or launching a new technical product. What tends to happen is we go in with good intentions, and sooner or later we hit the wall because those good intentions aren't enough. And what the Ship It Journal forces you to do is get uncomfortable early, get uncomfortable at the beginning, make hard decisions with rigor, not just by yourself, but among a group. So what I'm hoping you're going to do is take the instructions I'm going to share with you, take the journal you've got in your hand, and work your way through it. Emphasis on the word work. It's a process. It's a process to be done with all the people on your team. As you get in the habit of using it, what you will discover is a dramatic shift in your productivity and a real change in the way you approach your work, your project, and your peers, because it gives you a chance to go pro. It gives you a chance to become a professional, to conquer the voice of the lizard brain, and to actually make something happen. I want to make it easy for you to trick yourself. And not just trick yourself, but trick the people that you're working with. And I mean trick in the best possible way. Everyone has good intentions when they decide to take on a project, when they decide that they're going to make something happen, when they sign up to ship something out the door. So if we all go in with such good intentions, why do so many things ship so late? Why do so many projects get bogged down? Why did the sequel to the Duke Nukem video game, one of the most popular games ever, never even ship? They had unlimited resources, unlimited money, unlimited time, and 8 years later, they finally gave up. What was going on? Why did that happen? Does it have anything to do with talent? If we define talent as doing the part of the work that means making the thing, I think the answer is clearly no. The issue is not talent. The issue is tricking part of your brain. And the part of the brain that we're after, the thing we want to corner and isolate and extinguish, or at least live with, is what I call the lizard brain. The lizard brain, the amygdala, right near the brainstem, it's the part of your brain that's in charge of fear and revenge and reproduction and fitting in. It's the part of your brain that doesn't argue with the chief because it's worried you get thrown out of the village and eaten by a saber-toothed tiger. So I want to trick the lizard. I want to soothe the lizard. I want to make it scarier for the lizard brain to speak up and hide and speak up and cause a fuss than it is to hide. I want to get it to relax or at least go away. My friend Steve Pressfield calls the voice of the lizard brain the resistance. The resistance is the one that's saying, this is all a bunch of hooey. The resistance is the one that keeps you from raising your hand after a speaker wants to wait till a few other people raise their hand. The resistance is the one that doesn't want you to give a presentation or volunteer to take on an assignment. We're going to extinguish the resistance. And the way we're going to do it is by using a book. Now, usually we don't write in books. There's sort of this notion that that's wrong. So I want you to write in this book. The entire idea of the Ship It Journal is that you will take a pen, not a pencil, but a pen, and write in it. And the reason you're going to write in it is you're making a statement. unequivocal, making it clear that this matters and it's important. The next part is, you don't do this by yourself. The Ship It Journal is sold in bulk packs of a few at a time because it's not the job of one person privately doing this. Everyone on your team gets a Ship It Journal. Everyone writes down what's going on. Everyone keeps track. And then when you ship, you can put it on your bookshelf and be proud of it. And if you don't ship, there it is in black and white or blue and white. You're writing, saying what you were going to do, isolating your fears, and then you got chicken and you didn't ship. So that's what we're going to do. If you have the guts to start the journal, I think you're going to be way closer to shipping. It's the lizard that doesn't want you to start. It's the lizard who says, this is way too rigorous. This feels artificial. Well, it might be artificial, but compared to not shipping, it's a good thing. So what I'm going to do is talk you through some of the pages in the Ship It Journal so that you can understand what I meant and you can redefine them for your own, because it's your tool, not mine. Don't send it to me when you're done. Send it to the people on your team and congratulate each other. So let's just skip to the first page that has lines on it. And it says at the top, what's the project? You can't have a project you're going to ship unless you can tell me what it is. The project is, as concretely as you can, in a few sentences, tell me what it is, when it's going to be done, and how you can tell from the outside whether it is what it's supposed to be. And then, there at the bottom, you give me the date and the time it's going to be done. Not a range, not about, not early fall or late spring, but a date and a time. And it's okay with me if you pick a date and a time really far in the future, but you have to pick one. Next page, who is responsible for shipping it? I want names here. You can list everyone on the team, but then someone's name gets an asterisk next to it. Not two people or four people or the subcommittee or the tiger team, one person. One person who is going to be held responsible for whether this thing ships or not. And yeah, go ahead and list the people who are responsible for the subsections, but someone's got to have their ass on the line or it's not going to matter. The next page is going to surprise you a little bit because instead of talking about the details and the money, I ask, what are you afraid of? Because it's your fear of getting called out, your fear of being embarrassed, your fear of feeling like you're not good enough. That's the resistance. That's what the lizard brain is going to keep surfacing every time it gets difficult. Now, if you're working on an easy project, like you're a crossing guard and you need to get three kids to cross the street and you do it 50 times a day, well, you don't need this book. And the reason you don't need this book is you've done it before and it's easy. It's not necessarily physically easy. If you were blind or in a wheelchair, it would be really difficult. But for you, it's easy. You've done it before. There is no fear. I'm not interested in that project. I'm interested in the project with uncertainty. I'm interested in the project where you feel the stakes are really high, where you're not confident about how obvious and easy it is to do. So I want to know what you're afraid of. Then I ask again, but this time I want you to tell me what you're really afraid of, what you're not willing to write down. And writing down what you are afraid of declaws the lizard. It calls the bluff of the resistance. Because if you write it down, then the next part, why are you afraid, starts feeling sort of trivial. Because that thing you say you're afraid of isn't so scary when you write it down. And the reasons behind it, the rational parts behind it, all of a sudden it becomes, evaporates right before your eyes. And it's not nearly the problem that you thought it was going to be. The next page, we shift gears and I say, pick some edges. Here's the thing. Any project that's worth doing is worth doing because it's not been done this way before. If you're going to open an ice cream stand and it's just like the Carvel right down the street, you're not going to get more than your fair share of business. So every project that you launch to the public, every project that you launch to businesses, every internal project has edges. It might be open or it might be closed. It might be easy, it might be difficult. It might be fast to use or slow to use. You might do it solo or you might do it in a group. And I've given you a list of a dozen here, but there are many more. What I'm arguing for is this. When you set out to do it, you wanted to make it edgy. You know, compared to a product from, say, Microsoft, the iPad is edgy. Not a lot of compromises in what it can do or how it does it. It's rigorous. They went to certain edges, and they went all the way to those edges. There are other ones they don't care that much about. It's heavy. It could have been lighter. They would have had trade-off to make it lighter. But in other ways, they decided what the edge was, and they stuck with it. That's your challenge. Announce what the edge is. Make it clear what the edge is, because along the way, people are going to want you to compromise. People are going to say, trade this in and it'll go a little better. Trade this in, it'll be a little cheaper. Trade this in, it'll be a little faster. And there are some things I want you to trade in because you've got to get it done. But there are other things, the edgy things, the things you did it for in the first place, you must never trade those in. You must be intransigent on those items, because otherwise you ship mediocrity, and mediocrity is not worth shipping. Now I want to know who you're trying to please. There are people you don't think you're trying to please, like your mother-in-law or the person on the shipping dock or the receptionist, but you discover you start making changes to please them. So I want you to put in writing who exactly needs to love this, because that gives you the courage to ignore everyone else. All too often we care what an anonymous commenter says on our blog or what someone says in the Twitter sphere, even though they will never buy anything from us and no one believes them. We care what the boss's boss's boss thinks if, God forbid, she sees it. But she doesn't really have any power over this project, so why are we trying to please her? We got to be really clear about who is the client. Next page. I want to know who are the key influencers, gatekeepers, and authorities that are going to have decision-making power over you. And then I want to know if there's anyone else you forgot. Because if that's the list, then that's the list. Those are the people we need in our meeting, and we don't need anyone else. Those are the people we need to cater to, not anyone else. And understanding this rigorously and aggressively limiting who gets their hands on it will dramatically increase your chances of shipping. Oh, this one's fun. The next page is all about the devil's advocate. And what I'd like you to do on this page is read it out loud. It's too soon. It's too late. It's technically risky. It's not boring, or it's not boring enough. It will offend retailers. Blah, blah, blah. It's never been done before. It's been done before. Once you say them out loud, their power goes away. Once someone says them to you in a review or a meeting, pull out the booklet. Show it to them. Oh, I knew that already. We've heard what the devil's advocate had to say, and the fact is, the devil's doing just fine. He doesn't really need an advocate. So now we go back to those gatekeeper idea, and now I want to see a list of who internally can stop this project. Who are the people in the organization who, if they chose, could keep you from moving forward? List them. And then below it, list the external people, whether it's the head of the FDA or the buyer at Walmart. We need to know who those people are, because once again, we're trying to get real clarity about who gets authority over the work we're doing. Then I want to know who is essential to your success. Who, internal, has to embrace this for it to work. These are the people at the second tier. These are the people who have influence, not authority. These are the people who have access to resources. Once we know who they are, now we've got our go-up list. These are people we can charm and cajole and persuade. And next to each one, I want to put a little checkbox next to people who in the past have embraced new ideas, in the past have been willing for something to go to the edges, because those people are your go-to people. Those people are the ones who are going to transform the project you're working on. Now I want you to shift gears, and I want you to tell me, you the perfectionist, you the person who's worried about criticism, you the person who's been working so hard on this project, I want you to tell me, what does perfect look like? Be really specific about your vision of perfect. Because, if you turn the page, I don't think perfect is possible. I don't think perfect is likely. I don't think perfect is something you should fall in love with. So now I want you to make a list of what does good enough look like. What are the things you're willing to give on as long as you get the things you want? What's better, to never ship perfect or to always ship good enough? The definition of good enough means it's good enough for your customers. It's good enough to be remarkable. It's good enough to make a difference in the marketplace. And if you can regularly and consistently ship good enough, perfect becomes irrelevant. The next two pages you can expand into a digital document or a whiteboard or a whole book. I want to know every single task that needs to happen, by whom and when. And it could be, for a little project, just 30 things. But for a big project, it could be exhaustive. For a big project, it could be a book full. When they built the IBM 360 computer, we're talking about hundreds and hundreds of people working for years to ship something out the door. Making the list was a job in itself, a full-time librarian doing nothing but keeping track of the list. Here's the thing, guys. If you don't have a list, how will you know if you're on track? If you don't have a list, how is it possible that communication will work the way you want it to work? We're jumping around a lot page by page here because I don't want you to dig yourself a hole or find yourself in a corner. So the next thing is, I want to know who is about to become your competition. When you launch a new project, it means you've just entered into a competition with someone else. Someone else also has a gluten-free bakery in town, like the one you want to run. Somebody else is going to be competing with you for that iPad app sale. Somebody else is going to be calling on Bed Bath & Beyond to get shelf space for what you're about to do. I want to know who you see as your competition. And the reason is really interesting. The reason is, once you know who you're about to compete with, you can get in touch with what you're really afraid of. Because losing is something we're afraid of. Who are you going to lose to? You're going to lose to the competition. So I want you to call them out by name. Moving on, the next page is entitled, What Does Failure Look Like? And what I'd like you to do is list in writing everything you're anxious about. I think it's worth taking a moment to understand the difference between anxious and eager. Don't say we're anxious to have you come over to dinner. That means we're anticipating some sort of horrible outcome. Eager is the way we feel when we can't wait for something to happen. Anxious is the doorway to anxiety. And as you've probably heard me say before, anxiety is merely experiencing failure in advance. So the power of this page is that by writing down the things that you're anxious about, you can diffuse them and make them less powerful. The next page is all about Donald Bradman. Donald Bradman was the greatest athlete who ever lived. He was 3 times better at cricket than Michael Jordan was at basketball. He was essentially perfect at playing cricket. No one will ever be born who was better at the fundamental act of hitting the ball than he was. Here's the problem. The problem is you look at your project, you look at your task, and you wonder, how would it be done if Donald Bradman did it? How could it be done by that person who was born to do it, the person who seems gifted? And then you say to yourself, but that's not me. And so it's easy to sabotage the project, and it's easy to walk away or diminish the project. But in fact, that's not what happens in the real world. Let's look at a simple laboratory, TED.com. It's a website where you can see hundreds of speeches from some very big thinkers. Some of the people who have given those speeches were born to do it. Ken Robinson gets up and talks for 18 minutes about education, and you can just see, not only did he prepare, but he's great at it. He has a natural charisma and a connection with the audience. But wait, the number two person who has a video on TED is Jill Bolte Taylor. She's a professor of neurobiology at Harvard, and she studies strokes, and she had a stroke. So here's a woman who has had a huge impact medically on her life, who isn't comfortable talking to thousands or millions of people, who doesn't walk into a cocktail party and wow everyone with her funny stories. She is not the Donald Bradman of giving a speech. And yet, not only did she ship one, she shipped one of the greatest 18-minute speeches of all time, one that had people in the audience both cheering and crying at the same time. She stood on stage with nothing but a brain in her hand, a real brain just out of the formaldehyde, and told the story of her stroke and how she interacted with herself and the world around her. If she had looked at Ken Robinson's talk 3 weeks or 3 months before she gave her talk, she never would have done it. She brought something else to it. She brought something else other than, I am a gifted speaker. She brought preparation. She brought emotion. She brought emotional labor. One of the other talks that I love is Elizabeth Gilbert, standing up on stage for 18 minutes, talking about genius and innovation and creativity. Well, I found out from her later that she had practiced it for 4 hours every day for 3 months, and that all of her little asides and all of her little funny witticisms had been practiced. And that what Elizabeth Gilbert did was she acknowledged to herself that she wasn't Julia Roberts. She acknowledged to herself that she couldn't just go up and wing it because she's gifted. She treated it like a project. She treated it like a professional. And step by step, second by second, minute by minute, she brought from deep within her assets and effort that Donald Bradman would never have needed to do it if he was a public speaker. So what I'm challenging you to do on this page is to get over the fact that you are not the best blank who ever lived, because you're not. And instead say, what emotional labor are you going to bring? What insight are you going to bring? What team members are you going to assemble so this project is actually worth doing? So that's a pretty intense exercise. So let's take a little aside here and talk about meetings. Those of you who know me know that I'm not a fan of them. And I've listed here a few questions that you could ask yourself and others before you go to that next meeting. I guess what I'm trying to push for is this. Which is more important, pleasing people who like to go to meetings or shipping? That's your choice. You can do one or the other, but you can't do both. And what I'm challenging everyone who touches this booklet to do is sign off on this page and say, we have decided as an organization, it is more important to ship this thing than it is to have another meeting about it. And here it is in writing. Feel free to wave it around the next time you're in a meeting that's wasting your time. So you might feel a little beaten up right now because you've been forced to categorize your thrashing and compelled to become rigorous. And you've added a level of formality to work that used to be informal. It should make you uncomfortable. The reason it's making you uncomfortable is it's more comfortable to not ship. It's more comfortable to stick with the tried and true, to blame the process, to blame the system. It's more comfortable to follow the leader than be the leader. And what I've done is set you up to be really uncomfortable because I'm calling your bluff. And the people in this room, as you're working through this booklet, are calling your bluff. Do we care enough to ship? If we care enough to ship, let's actually do it. So it's worth reminding yourself that a feeling is about to show up, which is the feeling of doing something for the first time. And if you think about it, we go through a period of our development where we do lots of things for the first time. The first time we go to first grade, the first time we graduate from a school, the first time we get a first job, the first time we go on a date. And then a rhythm sets in and we stop remembering what it's like to do something for the first time. And the magic of shipping for me, the wonder of it, is it gives you a chance to experience that feeling again. The first time they shipped an iPad out the door, the first time someone cut the ribbon on a building that you designed and developed and built, the first time someone walked in to your little shop. Those are special events and they only occur to people who ship. So I want you to write down that feeling because that's what this is about at some level, is your chance to make that sort of impact. Steve Pressfield talks about turning pro, and it had a huge impact on me. If you talk to someone, interact with someone, work with someone who is a professional at shipping, you will discover they don't go into work the same way you do. You will discover they walk through the office differently, have different interactions, use their time differently. To be professional at shipping, to be a pro at approaching the idea of managing a project, requires a different posture and a different attitude. And I'm challenging you to write that down. And while you're writing it down, if you turn the page, you'll see a headline that has the word shame in it. We don't talk about the word shame a lot at work, but in fact, it drives a lot of our behavior. You're worried that people will say, you know, you're not as good as you think you are. You're worried that people are going to call your bluff. You're worried that you're going to start acting like a pro and people are going to say, get off your high horse. Who do you think you are? So what I want you to do to challenge this is give me a list instead of what you're going to hear when you fall on your face, of what you're going to hear when you ship. How are people going to interact with you differently when you are a professional at shipping, when you understand how to make projects go out the door? The key part here is not how good the actual item is. You'll get better at that. The key part is the act of shipping. If you get good at shipping, everything else will take care of itself. The last page, then, I don't want you to write in yet. It's the one page we're reserving. This is the page where after you've shipped, after you've received the standing ovation, after you've made an impact, after you've done the work that matters, I want you to write down how it felt. The act of writing it down is a celebration, and it begins a habit, because you're going to put one after another of these journals in your bookshelf as you do bigger and bigger projects. When you get in the habit of writing down how it felt to ship, you'll be able to chronicle your maturation as a project manager. You'll be able to show yourself what it means to turn pro and to fight the resistance and to do the work that matters. Basically, you're going to become a linchpin.